This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about how higher education institutions across Indiana are responding to the pandemic and how they're planning for the upcoming fall semester. Just as the response to the pandemic has varied across states and cities, colleges and universities are also weighing their options to offer education while protecting the health of students, faculty, and the surrounding communities. And if you have questions or comments for our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give us your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we will do our best to get it into the conversation today. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Joining me are three guests. Sue Elsperman is the president of Ivy Tech Community College of Indiana, and she joins us by phone. Sue Elsperman, welcome.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Robert Manuel is the president of the University of Indianapolis, and he joins us via Skype.
Good afternoon. It's good to be here.
And also with us via Skype is Sarah Smith Robbins, the director of learning technologies at Indiana University's Kelly School of Business. Welcome, Sarah.
Happy to be here.
Sue, we'll start with you. The question of how schools will reopen is, of course, front of mind right now with fall right around the corner. Just last week, you were invited to the White House for a national dialogue on safety safety in reopening America's schools. Can you talk about the themes that you heard from leaders and educators here at this summit?
Sure. I think for everyone, it was understanding that safety is paramount, whether we're talking about young children or college-age students, and equally our faculty and staff that are working here. So safety is absolutely paramount, and that's what we heard from the CDC as well in terms of the guidelines that they spoke to and the importance of, balanced with the importance of continuing to learn and for us to ensure that our students are able to gain the credentials they need to be successful in their careers. So it certainly, it's a balancing act, but everyone felt, and I think we still believe, that there is a path to doing this in a safe way, particularly in higher education. That's not to be confused with easy, but there is a safe way to do it.
So can you tell us about the reach that Ivy Tech Community College has in Indiana? Who is your typical student, and how many of those students do you serve?
Right. And that's where community colleges look a little different than what many people think about traditional higher education. We reach about 160,000 students a year across the state of Indiana. As you know, we are Indiana's community college. We're 18 campuses, 40 locations, and then another 60,000 high school students that we will reach in the high schools in dual credit or dual enrollment setting. So we're across the state. Our student, though, is primarily an adult, about 30 years old, usually a working adult, many of them having children and families. So they're part-time. They're here for a couple of hours at a time. In and out. And so we know that our student looks a little different. They don't live with us 24/7 like a residential college, and therefore we really have a different way of approaching them. And I should say, even pre-COVID, one out of three of our students was taking their class online. So we're certainly a different than the traditional 18-year-old, though we have lots of traditional 18-year-olds. We have a lot more non-traditional students as well.
And so when COVID hit, those students who were taking classes online, nothing really changed for them. But how did Ivy Tech adjust for the other students when the pandemic hit last semester?
Correct. So I should say that 18 months to 2 years ago, because so many of our students were taking classes online, we worked very diligently to improve our online courses. There's a traditional gap between face-to-face courses and pass rate, successful completion of online courses. So we've been working very hard as a college to reduce that gap, eliminate that gap. And as a result, all of that additional effort we've been putting in training faculty, improving the technology we had, realigning how we structured it, prepared us so that when we went all virtual, on March the 20th. That was not so difficult for us. We had the technology. Our faculty were prepared to do it. And so the transition was pretty successful for our students. We lost very few students to that. Now we had to stop some classes that were hands-on and lab-based courses. And those, by the way, were completing this summer. We just started 2 weeks ago something we call completion academies to ensure that those students can continue progressing in their coursework towards their degrees. So our that transition and all the credit goes to faculty for making that happen in a smooth, successful way for our students. They went into virtual, so many of the Zoom kind of classes that you would see. And then, of course, the online, we're already online. And because we're predominantly 8-week courses now, we were just beginning our second 8 weeks. At that time, so we were able to transition more into that 8-week, which has more options again in that virtual or online setting as well. So it was challenging to say the least, but it went pretty well, better than we would have expected or any of us going into that. I think you can say that about higher ed overall, and I know that President Manuel will talk about that, but higher ed did step up to going virtual and making it successful for our students.
We're talking about the COVID-19 pandemic as it relates to higher education in Indiana. We've been speaking with Sue Elsperman, the president of Ivy Tech Community College. We also have Sarah Smith Robbins, director of learning technologies at Indiana University's Kelly School of Business, and Robert Manuel, the president of the University of Indianapolis. Robert, we're going to jump to you now. So UIndy presents a very different set of considerations. Students are often they often live on or near campus, and a lot of those students are typically enrolled in a lot of in-person classes. So how did UIndy develop its response to COVID-19?
So the similarity with what President Elsperman was talking about is that we balance the care for the community, our faculty, staff, our students, and the people that live in and around our community on the south side, with the ability for our students to progress through their academic careers and into their professional careers. And so I think every institution in Indiana had that as their kind of primary concerns. What we had been doing for quite some time is investing in the technology, the way that technology is used inside of our classrooms. And so while the time frame to turn 2,000 course sections online was about a week for us, the concept of doing that was not foreign. There have been massive investments in the learning management system, in the technology we use to communicate, in the way that we distribute information and expect our students to engage with each other. The timing was very difficult. The faculty and the staff and the administration at UIndy were remarkably creative in finding how to turn our offerings into remote learning in quick time, as was every institution in America. But we have been investing in this for quite some time, and so the shock of it all was really more about how do we do it in a short period of time versus is it such a new and foreign concept to the education that we offer.
How involved have epidemiologists and medical professionals been in crafting the plan for the upcoming semester?
So we have led with the public health concern first, the financial concern second, and we have gathered a series of professional epidemiologists and infectious disease experts to guide our thinking about how we open. And if you look at our phased opening, we are opening much slower than the state or the federal government would have asked us to, in part because we could. Our summer months are usually a little bit slower, and in part because we wanted to make sure we had our preparations ready on campus to receive students, faculty, and staff in professional ways and safe ways. They're guiding us on how to interpret the unbelievable amounts of data that are out there on what's actually happening and allowing us to be grounded in the public health data as we decide how to go forward. The joke around our table a lot is, you know, all of my friends from high school on Facebook are now epidemiologists. But the truth is we've really focused on doctors and our relationships with IU Health and Community Health Network and St. Francis to help us understand how to move forward.
And as we mentioned, your students don't just learn on campus, they live on campus. How are operations like housing and dining going to look different this year?
So in keeping with the kind of public health expectations, we've de-densified our campus by more than 50%. So we have room for 1,450 beds on campus and another 2,000 in college-owned apartments around. We're only going to be operating that at 50% to make sure we are not creating migratory patterns of students that present the opportunity for the disease to spread. We have we're only going to use 50% of our classrooms at 50% capacity, and still with all of and I've bought more hand sanitizer and masks than you could imagine. And we're also changed more than 35 policies on campus to make sure that we are not inadvertently, intentionally or unintentionally, spreading the disease around through the students that are here. We took all of our courses and modified them into type 1s, 2s, or 3s, where they were either going to be fully online, they were going to be hybrid, or they needed to be face-to-face. We have courses in nursing and physical therapy and occupational therapy and counseling that need to have face-to-face interactions. And we prioritize their appointments into classrooms in ways that will help social distancing and hope to ensure the safety of the students.
Sarah Smith Robbins, many students and faculty might be familiar with online classes, of course, but we're certainly seeing a heightened level of reliance on virtual education. You assist educators with the transition from in-person classes to online. How's that been going?
Surprisingly well. I think attitude had a large part in it. Everybody felt equally scared about the epidemic and wanted to care for one another. And so as soon as we needed to go online, everybody was ready to do it.
And Sarah, let me just interrupt you. I wasn't keeping an eye on the clock, and that is my fault. We have to take a quick break. We'll come right back with you, and we'll talk about how higher ed is responding to the pandemic and planning for the fall semester. And if you have questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. I'm Matt Pelser, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about how higher education institutions across Indiana have continued to respond to the pandemic and what this upcoming fall semester will look like. And we would love your questions and comments on the topic. We are on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from to 866-476-3881. We would love to hear your voice in the conversation today. We're joined again by three guests. Sue Elsperman is the president of Ivy Tech Community College of Indiana. Robert Manuel is the president of the University of Indianapolis, and Sarah Smith Robbins is the director of learning technologies at Indiana University's Kelly School of Business. And just before the break, I rudely interrupted Sarah. We were talking about moving to online classes and how that's been going. So Sarah, forgive me. Go right ahead.
No problem at all. It was important to us early on that the fears or the negative connotations that students might have about online learning be dispelled really quickly. And so we were really careful to ensure that all of our online classes, either overnight online classes back in March or going forward, are really high touch with students and that they see that they have just as much interaction with faculty as they would have had, probably more interaction with their instructors than they would have had in a purely face-to-face class. And so we've been relying on technologies like our learning management system and like lots of Zoom calls. And we're also using Microsoft Teams, which allows us to have this kind of ongoing informal conversation between students and with faculty. And so all those tools have sort of helped us shrink that gap that is perceived between an online student and their instructor.
What advice do you give to faculty who are maybe some of them learning to teach online for the first time? Does a change in this kind of format call for a change in the way they approach a class?
Yeah, I think it does. You have to remember that most faculty are PhDs, and most of us PhDs don't actually learn how to teach as part of our program. So the way we teach is predominantly based on how we've been taught. And most of our faculty will not have had an online course as part of their program. So they've never been in that situation. So I always encourage instructors to take an online class if they can, even if it's just like a LinkedIn Learning class, something very small, just to see some of the options that are out there in the different formats. But then I also remind them that they're human and their students are human and they're part of a community of learners with their students. And so if they make mistakes, if they click the wrong button, it's not the end of the world. Their students will forgive them. If you make a mistake in your classroom, you don't walk out and come back and start over again. You just roll with it. And so that's what we encourage faculty to do, even if they're teaching online or hybrid.
And you said that students might get more interaction with their teachers under this sort of new system. What about with their peers who they aren't seeing day to day? Have you heard anything about that?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. And I've sort of been facing that personally, too, because I have triplets who will be freshmen at IU this year.
Oh, boy.
And I know. And we've had lots of conversations among our family and at work about ensuring students have that connection to one another. And there's a lot of learning that goes on in those informal communications that students have in the hallways. And so we're going to be working with students to help them understand how they can stay in touch with one another and using chat and instant messaging and WhatsApp and things like that to get more communication between students happening and more team projects where they meet independently outside of their typical classroom time to work with each other. I think all those things are going to be important.
Sue Ellsperman, what about students training to be welders or nurses? I mean, are online classes a sufficient substitute for all students? Those are some fields that you really kind of need in-person instruction.
Yes, of course. And that's our focus has been to make sure that those students who need to be on campus for face-to-face classes and labs and hands-on learning can do that. So this fall, we will be about 30% of our students will be here on campus. The others will be in either a blended, you heard the blended or hybrid approach where maybe once a week they're here and the other time their class is meeting in a virtual manner. And then there'll be lots of additional online sessions and virtual sessions as well. So you're absolutely correct. We know that our students, both those who are taking curriculum which requires that hands-on lab-based learning, but also we know with a lot of adult learners, they're just more comfortable in a face-to-face setting, and we want to make sure we're meeting students where we are. When you're a non-traditional student coming back after 10 or 15 years of being out of high school, there's enough anxiety to not add online to that if you're not comfortable there yet. So we want to be able to meet that student where they are and have the right kind of section for them. Interestingly, we did a survey. We're in the middle of a survey to all of our students right now. The interesting thing is they have rated hybrid as their preferred method of taking those courses, followed by online, followed by virtual, followed by face-to-face, which is fascinating. Our provost was shocked to see that face-to-face, we always assume face-to-face is the preferred method, but I think our students are very sensitive to knowing the risks that are out there right now, knowing that they can learn effectively. We've been doing hybrid now for several years. And they're very comfortable with that. They have a very good experience. They have kind of the best of both worlds of being on campus part of the time, but doing some of that work more independently. And so it has been interesting to see where our students are. And that's, again, in community college, we really need to meet our students where they are. We want them to succeed. We understand the complexity of their lives, their work commitments, their family commitments. Interesting that I think as we come into this fall, we're well prepared to meet those who need to be face-to-face in that setting and having other options for those who do not.
Sarah Smith-Robbins, outside of minimizing health risks, are there other ways that students actually benefit from online classes?
Oh, for sure. This is the direction that work is going in general. You know, we're doing more work remotely, and there are far more collaborative relationships with colleagues that happen completely online. And I think it's actually kind of exciting that students are going to be adding an additional skill set to what they're learning in their courses. They're also learning how to work online. And we actually encourage our faculty to think about their class as a virtual team rather than as a class. So it's less about one person, the instructor, being in charge of everything and leading every conversation, and to think about it more of as a learning community that's collaborative. And those are the kind of skills that I think students will be able to apply in the workplace when they're done with school.
Robert Manuel, we know that those economic benefits that certain economic benefits are only viable if students and the workforce alike are healthy, if everyone's healthy. So UND partnered with local healthcare systems to provide access to testing, tracing, and treatment. So how is this going to work?
So we are setting aside space on campus and space in nearby hotels to help any isolation or quarantine space that we need, and we're to use in that capacity. And we're also partnering with the professionals at those hospital systems to help us understand how to treat and care for the environment and make sure the students or the people that are in those quarantine spaces are cared for. We've also made sure that we worked with those health organizations, one, to inform us about how we should operate and how we shouldn't operate in this. And that comes down to specific areas like our athletic teams. We have more than 750 student athletes that are competing on the Division II level, and they have created testing protocols and distancing protocols and sanitation protocols with us so that we have the benefit of kind of the most current thinking in the health field. And then also, we partner with them to prepare our professionals who are going to inherit jobs in those areas to know what it means to be working in this kind of a space. So we have nursing school, physical therapy, occupational therapy, counseling, public health, social work, and all of those systems are helping our students and our faculty connect the education to the reality that our students are going to inherit when they graduate.
I feel like we have to talk about this. So, I mean, some communities that are home to colleges and universities are really wary of students coming back to campus because they fear that while college students who are young people might be able to fight the virus, they might spread it to more vulnerable members of the community or spread it around the community. So Marion County has been one of the hardest hit counties in the whole state. How has UIndy been thinking about protecting the community that surrounds it?
Mm-hmm. So one, we're educating the students that live in the community. Even though they're not in university-owned housing, we work both with the landlords and with the students to help them understand their responsibility to the people they live in and amongst. Two is we have made it very clear that there are expectations we have of our students in terms of their behaviors that will be monitored both with our public safety officers and with our student affairs officers. And then three, we're opening up all of the services and the support that we have at the university to members of our community, which would include the education and the knowledge around how to get and use PPE, and also potentially access to the testing capabilities that the university has. And so we treat them as a fourth, at least a quarter of the population that we try to create services and opportunities for.
Robert, we have a question from Mike on Facebook who says, can we hear more about measures being taken to ensure safety for students who will be on campus and plans for reacting to COVID cases on campus? We've talked a little bit about that, but I think that second part bears a little attention. How will what's your plan to react to COVID cases spreading around campus?
Sure. So let me take one step back because there's a tweet in here, too, about what about the HVAC systems, which is as much a part of the safety and security of our students as we go. And about 6 months ago, when we realized that the coronavirus was going to hit, we did a complete sweep of every policy and practice we have at the university to try to say, does it help or hurt what we think would be coming with this pandemic? And so to keep our students safe, we have changed just about every possible way that students migrate, collect, connect, engage, and the physical arrangements around them to make sure that they're as safe as they can be. So, for example, with the HVAC, we've adjusted the amount of air that comes in from the outside, depending upon what time of the day it is and how many people are in the buildings, to be as much as 100%, which would allow for the circulatory patterns to be more conducive to being safe and healthy. We are also ensuring policies that make requirements happen that help with the lack of the spread of this virus. So we have a mask required policy. We had that before Marion County instituted it. And instead of requiring people to find their own PPE, we're supplying their PPE for them. And we're also putting in some technology in place that helps us with line queuing. So for office hours, students that want to sign up for office hours will no longer wait together in the hallway. They'll sign up on this app, which will tell them what time their appointment is with their faculty member, and then they and they alone can be there during that time. And so everything has changed to make sure that we are being as safe as we can. And when I wrote a note to the community about 3 weeks ago, and I said, we are doing everything we can to do this, but the community needs to know that we can't prevent people from becoming positive. What we can do is provide as much support as we can for them should they become positive. And so that includes symptomatic testing. It includes psychological care and counseling care should they need it. And because we have many students that come from all over the world and the country, we also need to provide isolated quarantine space for anybody that does become ill for us to manage their care until and unless they have another place to go.
Sarah Smith Robbins, I want to go back to the subject of virtual learning, which often raises a question of equity. Does your team work to make virtual learning more accessible to students in all kinds of circumstances?
Yeah, it's a really important topic. So we try to have in mind the full range of access that a student may have to technology, to a good internet connection, et cetera. And so Kelly has been teaching online. We've had an online MBA program for 20 years now. And even within our graduate student population, we have such a wide range from students who have, you know, great access to a great computer, all the way to students who are active military and only connect to the internet twice a week and have to download all of their coursework at once, work on it, and then upload it all at once. And so we do things like we discourage faculty from posting videos of lectures that are longer than 15 minutes so that the file sizes are nice and small. So if you have a slow connection, you can watch a series of videos to get that lecture rather than one big video. We encourage faculty to think about accessibility in terms of disability as well. And so we think about the format that documents are in, the format that assignments take, and we have accessibility experts who review our courses and make sure that no matter what your connection is or your abilities are, that you're going to have that same high quality learning experience.
Robert, some colleges and universities have adopted an alternative calendar for the 2020 school year, which eliminates fall break, holiday breaks, and it concludes on-campus instruction after Thanksgiving. Has UIndy's calendar changed?
Yeah, it changed about 2 months ago. The Faculty Senate endorsed a change to the calendar, which moved our start date into August 1 month or 1 week earlier. So we now start on the 23rd, 24th, instead of a week later. We've eliminated all vacations, and we end our on-site experiences in Thanksgiving, taking our finals the week after Thanksgiving. And I'll tell you that part of the reason to do that was to change the migratory patterns of our students. So having breaks where they can go home and travel to their, or take breaks and come back to the campus was, on advice of the public health experts we consult, not the concerning in terms of potentially creating more spread of the virus. And so what we've done is created an environment where we go from August 23rd until Thanksgiving without break and attempt to keep everybody on campus inside of the bubble as best we can.
And Sarah, we've just got about a minute left. I remembered this time. Are faculty and educators at the Kelly School being advised to prepare for a shift to exclusively online learning if we see a rise in cases in the fall?
Absolutely. We're being advised to be as flexible as possible. So as the others have mentioned, we have hybrid classes. We have a model called a rotational hybrid, and then we have all online. And all of those are being designed with the thought that they may have to go purely online at a moment's notice.
We've been talking with Sarah Smith-Robbins, Director of Learning Technologies at Indiana University's Kelly School of Business, as well as Robert Manuel, President of the University of Indianapolis. We also have Sue Elsperman with us. She's President of Ivy Tech Community College in Indiana. And there is a lot more to talk about. We'll keep the conversation going after a quick break. We're talking to these high ed leaders about how the fall semester is going to look for students, faculty, and communities as the pandemic continues. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in less than 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on how higher education institutions are continuing to respond to COVID-19 and prepare for the fall semester. And as always, we would love your questions and comments. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail. We need your first name and where you're calling from, and you can do that at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. We're joined again by our three guests, Sue Elsperman, the president of Ivy Tech Community College of Indiana, Robert Manuel is the president of the University of Indianapolis, and Sarah Smith-Robbins is the director of learning technologies at Indiana University's Kelly School of Business. And we're also welcoming this segment Hannah Buxbaum, vice president for international affairs at Indiana University. Hannah, we're glad to have you with us.
Hi, happy to be joining you.
And so last week, Hannah, Immigration and Customs Enforcement unveiled a new federal student visa policy, which says that international students cannot take exclusively online classes at their colleges this fall. If they do, they run the risk of losing their visa status. Can you tell us more about this new policy and what it means for international students here in the States?
Yeah, this new policy actually relates to a longstanding rule regarding online education of international students. So the rule says that international students can only get a visa to study in the U.S. if most of their program will be in person at the college or the university where they're enrolled. So, you know, they can take one class online under this normal rule, but no more than that. And in March, when colleges and universities really across the country went to completely online teaching as a result of the pandemic, the DHS issued temporary accommodation, and it was very flexible. So it said that international students who chose to stay in the United States and therefore had shifted to a completely online course of study would be able to remain in active F1 status. So essentially, they retained their standing with immigration authorities. And it also permitted students who chose to return to their home countries to take online instruction remotely, but maintain their active record so that at some point when they return to the United States, they would not have lost their status as students studying in the United States. So it was very flexible accommodation, and DHS announced that as a temporary accommodation that would be in place for the duration of the emergency. Well, what happened last week is they issued new guidance, and essentially it says that any, as you said in the introduction there, any student who will be taking only online classes has to depart the United States. Now, some schools around the country have already announced that they will be completely online for the fall, like the Cal State system, for example. And this guidance would mean that those students have to depart the country now, all of their international students. Many other universities are, including Indiana University, is adopting a hybrid model. So we'll have some in-person classes, some online classes. And what the guidance means for our students is that each individual international student will have to have at least one in-person course experience in order to remain in the country. So it is very inflexible because, you know, it doesn't give the students the ability to say, well, you know, in light of my, let's say, health condition, I would prefer to remain all online. And, you know, I don't want to confront a choice between doing that and returning to my home country abruptly. So this guidance really forces students to choose and also forces universities to choose in balancing between the public safety imperative and the ability of our students to continue their progress toward degree. Now, it's been challenged. So Harvard and MIT filed a lawsuit last week, and the hearing in that litigation is actually taking place this afternoon. And in the meantime, there are some other lawsuits challenging this policy. So we are hoping that it will not be implemented, but it has had a very serious impact already on our international student population.
Are you hearing particular questions or concerns from your international students?
Quite a few, as you can imagine. So we have over 7,500 international students across our system on the Bloomington campus. That it's almost 5,500 students, and you know they are anxious, and some of them are terrified, frankly, of what this means for them and their not just their academic future, but their personal situation. And they know that Indiana University, like all universities, will have to make decisions in the interest of public safety. And if the pandemic gets worse and we are not able to maintain hybrid instruction but have to resume fully online, you know, under this guidance, that would mean they would have to pick up in the middle of the semester and return to their home countries. And, you know, I think in light of the ongoing mobility restrictions that are still in place, that is a very, very difficult proposition. There are still entry bans in some countries. There are few flights available. And frankly, there's the public health risk of traveling internationally. So yeah, this is it's very disruptive, and it's very scary for a lot of our students.
You described it as unconscionable. Why do you say that?
Well, you know, the motivation here, it seems pretty clearly to be leaning on colleges and universities to get back to normal operations. Mm-hmm. So the head of the DHS said as much in an interview last week that this is leverage, right, to encourage higher education to resume normal in-person instruction. And I think given the human cost, frankly, to our international students of putting them into this position, that really is an unconscionable strategy.
This return to normalcy, is that part of the reasoning the federal government has offered behind this policy, or is there more here?
Well, again, the head of DHS last week did say explicitly they want higher education to reopen for full in-person instruction.
And but to go after international students, it just seems like there might be something more there.
Well, I think certainly the administration has engaged in a number of recent moves to reduce immigration that is seen to impair the employment opportunities of Americans in the wake of the pandemic. But these are non-immigrant statuses, right? These are students. So they are not taking jobs away from Americans or anything like that. They are here to study. And so in that light, it's hard to see how this aligns with some of the other recent immigration policies that are more explicitly employment related.
We're talking to Hannah Buxbaum, the Vice President for International Affairs at Indiana University. And we also have Sue Elsperman, the President of Ivy Tech Community College of Indiana. Robert Manuel is the President of the University of Indianapolis. And Sarah Smith Robbins is the Director of Learning Technologies at Indiana University's Kelly School of Business. So, Sarah, even if faculty develop strong courses that can be taken entirely online, do you have concerns that the external factors that come with displacement could keep international students from finishing the semester that they started?
Absolutely. I mean, just moving house, just changing from one apartment to the other in the middle of a semester is traumatic to your academic progress, never mind being sent to another country. And we're dealing with firewalls and connectivity issues around the world. We don't always have an accurate sense of which technologies are accessible from where. And some of those things are changing. And so instructors have to think about all these contingencies as they're designing their courses. Can my students download the videos to a flash drive before they have to go somewhere, before they leave, and have all their course material with them wherever they go in case they can't reconnect? We have to plan for all of those possibilities.
Robert, UIndy welcomes international students every single year as well. How has your university responded?
The same way that the other 4,000 institutions in the U.S. are, which is we're very concerned for our students. We think this is another gut punch to higher education that at a time when we just don't need it. And we're trying to figure out how to manage the schedules in the worst pandemic of my lifetime to make sure that our students can, or international students can, comply with the standards of ICE. And I'll say that we have at the university only 400 international students, which for us is a large number. And we're in constant conversation with them all the time. And the concerns that this is creating isn't just, can I complete my academic career or will I be able to take my courses? It's, how will I live? How will I be safe? How will I find my way back if I needed to? And it is a huge undertaking at a time when we're already doing a huge undertaking to make sure we can continue to promote safe and quality education.
Sue Elsperman, does Ivy Tech serve international students as well?
As large as we are, we serve just everybody. So we have about 300. So in our 160,000 plus students, that 300 is a relatively small number. But we've planned to think it's unlikely that, unlike in March, where we went completely virtual across the state, given what we knew about COVID at the time, it is very unlikely that if we do need to go virtual, it will likely be surgical. Think about a campus. If Lake County exceeds or a particular hotspot develops or we have cases on one of our campuses, we wouldn't shut down the whole system. We would consider closing a campus for a week or two or three as we work through that time. So our commitment is that those students would be able to continue that course on another campus. Our campuses are about an hour apart. There are 18 across the state, and we would invite the same thing of the UIndy and the IU students should that come. And we have the eight-week format, which is another way to do, so there's two chances to get that in-person course. So we're committed to serving those international students. We think we're in a pretty good position to be able to help keep that commitment to them to have that in-person course. But I don't disagree that this is a difficult requirement of higher education and those international students.
Robert, the Center for Global Engagement at UIndy is dedicated to cultural diversity and international exchange. Can you talk about the work it takes to build a strong international program?
The relationships we have are both institutional based. We have relationships with the Ningbo Institute of Technology in China, where they're sending 80 students a year to us. We're sending students back to them and faculty back to them. We also have individuals that come to either compete on an athletics team or to take a course of study. Each one requires almost generations of relationships with the home country or the home counselor or the home institution to develop. And in order to do that, you have to both secure the academic progress, but make sure that you're providing the care for the human, the development of the human and the person as well. And so it has taken generations to get us to a point where we can welcome those 400 international students, care for them, and meet the expectations of their home entities. And this current rule change with ICE kind of beats us back a couple of years and hurts our ability to continue to make that relationship with those institutions. So it is a immediate effect right now, but it also serves some long-term effect in that we have to go back and re-engage those conversations and those relationships that we have with our international partners.
So, Hanna, it sounds like the new ICE policy has jeopardized UIndy's international program. Is it, or could it jeopardize international programs there at IU?
I think we're in a good position. So since we are adopting a hybrid model for the fall, and we did not plan to go completely online in any event, it's just a matter of really ensuring that all of the individual students have a course schedule that will keep them into compliance with the new policy. Now, that's no small task given an international population of the size we have, and it really means that department by department, you know, we need to see what is being offered and make sure that all of those course schedules get put together appropriately. So it's a major logistical challenge. And, you know, one of the frustrations with the recent guidance is the timing of it. You know, so we have like everywhere in higher ed, you know, we've been working for weeks and weeks to figure out how, with constrained classroom space and with the teaching resources we have available and with the students we have enrolled, how do we put this puzzle together into our curriculum for the fall? And to have this additional wrench thrown into the process at this late date is just causing a lot of work across the institution.
It is becoming clear that we could talk about this for a lot longer, but I'm afraid we're out of time for today. I want to thank all of our guests for taking the time today to talk with us about higher education amid the pandemic. Sue Elsperman is the president of Ivy Tech Community College of Indiana. Thank you so much. Robert Manuel is the president of the University of Indianapolis. Thanks to you.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah Smith Robbins is the director of learning technologies at Indiana University's Kelly School of Business. Thanks, Sarah.
My pleasure.
Hanna Buxbaum is the Vice President for International Affairs at Indiana University. Thank you, Hanna.
Thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about how the pandemic has impacted immigrants in Indiana and immigration policy. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana, and I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.